Viking. A person who loves food, we call a foodie. The person who loves like doing things like laying bricks is called a brickie. And someone who loves spending time on their mobile phones, what do we call them?
Phonies.
I think I made my point. Can you please explain the differences of Samatha meditation and Vipassana? There are no differences between Samatha meditation and Vipassana. Ajahn Chah used to say, this is the front of my hand. Can you see the back of my hand? It's there. I can see the back of my hand. You can't see the front of my hand. Wherever the back is, the front is. Like Samatha and Vipassana. You can't have one without the other. They're indivisible. My story was, there were these two, there was this couple, very devout meditators, Sam Atta, and Vi, Passama. And haven't finished yet, they had two dogs, Metta the dog, and Anna Parmasati dog. And after lunch one day, they decided to go up a walk up Meditation Mountain. Sam, he went up there because it was so peaceful and quiet at the top of Meditation Mountain. Why? She was a professional photographer. She took her amazing Canon camera with so many sort of filters because she liked taking these great capturing these incredible views of nature from up high in the mountain. Met the dog, she just went up there for fun. And Anna Parmasati went along with her. So, they only got halfway up a Meditation Mountain. And Sam was so peaceful, so tranquil, halfway up Meditation Mountain. I, even though there's a long way to go yet, she took these amazing insight shots where she could see so far, everything was laid out nice and clear. Amazing stuff. Metta the dog was getting so happy, even halfway up Meditation Mountain. You could see just she was running around, wagging her tail, all to such one happy dog. And Anapanasati was so even halfway up at Meditation Mountain. When they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, it was so incredibly, almost supernaturally peaceful and still up there. Sam was just enjoying the rapture of stillness. You know, Sam also had a pair of eyes. He could see incredible views. And he had so much love on top of Meditation Mountain. Wow, you can see everything on top of Meditation Mountain. And for Vi, she also had, she felt this incredible peace and stillness up there. Almost nothing moved. And also, she experienced a great joy and love on the top of Meditation Mountain. Met the dog, oh, she was wagging her tail like it would fall off. You know when dogs are really happy? You can see it. Now, she couldn't bark because it was too still to bark. But she could see and look at amazing views. But even dogs, sometimes in high places, you can see them just washing over the land. Also appreciating just the beauty of such an amazing place. Anapanasati had disappeared by then. The bird couldn't be seen on the top of Meditation Mountain. And that was my story. Oh, Meditation Mountain. It doesn't matter who goes up there, whether you go up there for the joy, the peace, or either let's start with the peace. With the stillness up there, that was Sam's main aim. You get up there, it's so peaceful up there, but I would also appreciate, see all the views, see everything up there. And have so much love and joy. And the same with the other two. Metta the dog goes up there for love, but also experiences great peace, great insights. And Vipassana, Vi, he also experiences great stillness, insights, and great joy and love. Because they all go together. And you see, one of the most important parts of that ceremony, we always talk about samatha vipassana, insight and stillness. That's so dry. It hasn't got the joy element, the love, the metta. And it's really important to put that metta in there as well. Not just samatha, not just vipassana, it will always go along with happiness and joy. Hi, loving retreat, O kindful one. Loving it already? Oh, that's what I warned you. If you get enlightened tonight, there's nothing to do the next 2 days. Anyway, rather than just knowing our awareness and kindness to focus on whatever's in front of the mind, is it also useful to practice flexibility of attention? For sometimes, if you're only focusing on the feet, on the floor, sometimes on breath, or sometimes on a more open and spacious awareness, I feel that may train the mind in a more deliberate way. Training the mind? Who's training the mind? Who's doing that? So instead of training the mind, instead of actually, one of the things which aspects of meditation, it's all a relationship that you have with the object of your mind. Quite frankly, it does not matter what you are aware of. What really matters is how you are aware. Are you trying to hold on to these even brilliant nimittas, to grab them? Are you trying to develop them, to make them better, which is another form of wanting or greed? What is your relationship with what you're doing? What is between you and your object? That's where you look. It's called, in UK, especially in London, mind the gap. The gap between you and the object. And sometimes I use that simply between where are you now and where do you want to be. That's a gap. And so people fall into that gap and come to grief. No, instead, where you are, where you want to be, make that the same place. I want to be here. They're all wanting an aversion. Disappear. Be peaceful. Be still. And stillness grows. Is there an age limit for getting ordained as a bhikkhuni? Not an age limit, but you still have to be alive, still breathing. But it's not so much discrimination according to age. It's just what is practical. So that if you are that old, that you have to have attendants look after you all the time. Now remember that just the attendants are usually other nuns, and so those other nuns don't have any time to do other things except look after you. And that's the only reason why that some of the communities say, well, look, we'd love to give you that opportunity, but that it's not the right environment for looking after someone so elderly. For example, even in some of the forest monasteries, it's in a forest, it's in hills. If you can't walk properly, then sometimes it's very difficult to get around. In our monastery in Australia, some of you have been there. We try to make it as comfortable as possible, but it is also very frugal. If anyone was in a wheelchair, if they lost control down one of those hills, at the bottom is a lake. That's where they end up. I'm not going to be able to stop them. It's not our fault. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. before you get old. Or don't. So, but there, against that, there is, we always look at people who've done service. That is wonderful gratitude. Even the Buddha did that. And so, if someone who's really served, then we just, oh, maybe we can stretch his age limits here, there, and everywhere. And if you're very fit, then fine. We have a lady, she used to be the secretary of our Buddhist Society in West Australia for many years, always a really good supporter, and so when she wanted to become a bhikkhuni, let her. And she's one of the most fittest and healthiest of them, lots of them. And it's wonderful. We actually gave her the name Gotami. And she's a really sweet, kind, old bhikkhuni. How old is she now?
76.
That's great, wonderful. So it's not just because you're old, it's just what is practical, that's all. But anyway, just don't wait for that to be a problem. Just do it. I found the Sufi study class very interesting and helpful. Is it possible to get a link to an online copy of the text you spoke of in the A4 path with wall greetings?
Not yet, no.
So look, reason is, the online, well, not really an online copy, it's just the one which is work in progress. Because I want to eventually just have it published, so it's published, so everyone can have a look at it. So anyway, I think there's...
It's in the work in progress.
What's the difference between awareness and consciousness? There are six different types of consciousness. In those translations, I haven't come to it yet, but you'll find, I never mention, say, in the khandhas, I call them the five components of existence rather than the five aggregates. Because having done a lot of building, aggregates means the stones you put into cement to make concrete. So anyway, so I call it five components of existence to make it a little bit more clear what these candles are about. And for, I never translate the fifth of those components of existence, the vijnana, as consciousness. I call it consciousnesses. You find it defined six separate kinds of consciousnesses. It is, it's that sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind consciousness. Those make the six consciousnesses. And whatever you say here, then that becomes an object of the mind consciousness. Even if you know something, then later on, usually a very short time afterwards, you know that you knew. So the consciousness takes its own as an object. So this is a process of conscious awareness. So the awareness, the mindfulness, is, if you like, part of that sixth consciousness. But if you look very carefully, you cannot be aware of two of those consciousnesses at the same time. When one arises, the other one is not to be seen. I developed, or had to develop, similes of the fruit salad. No actual fruit, some of these are veggies. So you have a plate in front of you, and it's an apple appears on your plate. And then the apple disappears and there's a coconut. And then the coconut totally vanishes and there's the banana. And the banana totally vanishes, another coconut. And there's a coconut after that. And then there's a cauliflower appears. And the cauliflower vanishes and then there's a coconut. And then a mango appears and then there's a coconut. Only one fruit at a time is allowed on the plate. So in this simile, it's not the best simile, but here we go. The apple signifies sight, apple of the eye. And then we have the cauliflower, stands for hearing. Cauliflower ear. Okay. You've got that one, Sarah. And a banana is a nose. That's a smell. Mango is a taste. And I didn't do the body awareness, did I? What's the body awareness? Okay, touch. Okay, we're on chili. Certainly know if you're eating chili. And a coconut is, you know, the mind. Just for the head. So anyway, this is just first matter, but the important thing is that one, only one at a time. That actually changes a lot of your understanding of this thing called conscious awareness, the flow, the process of awareness or consciousness. See this. They're not the same. One follows another. The only reason why people feel is a continuous process without breaks. It's because of our awareness is not fast enough. When I was a young boy, sometimes you could go to places like Brighton Pier or Southend or Blackpool, and you had these little machines. They're totally banned now. What the butler saw machine. And you put a penny in the slot, you wind it. And it was just a series of cards going fast and giving the appearance of continuous motion. The first type of like a video. And then you used to go to the movies. And then if you were lucky enough, you could see actually the film, the celluloid. It's a series of still photographs. Which, when they were went through the projector fast enough, it looked like it was just a real natural movement. And that's the same with consciousnesses. They go so fast, we see there's no space between them. But there are times where things stop or pause. But anyway. That is where you see the what consciousness is. But the interesting thing about awareness, because things move so fast, and because we are so tired and de-energized, even what we take as awareness is so dull. Which is why, in that book which I wrote, the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, in there I made a strong point that there are different levels of awareness. And just for looking for some way to describe them, I call them power awareness and superpower awareness. There are times when you meditate, you get very still. But whatever you see becomes very clear and strong. You're really aware. An example is that after one of the retreats, a personal retreat, which I do every year just for myself, 15 days in my cave. And after I came out in the morning, had a breakfast, and the first thing which I put in my mouth at that breakfast was a baked bean. A single bean. Not on toast, just one baked bean. I put it in my mouth. There was a taste explosion. Just you could the tomato sauce on the outside, slightly naturally sweet but also salty, and it had this flavour which was from my tip of my tongue, it spread throughout the whole mouth and up to my pleasure centres in the brain. And wow, it was amazing. You fully experienced the tomato sauce around the baked bean, and then I crunched into the bean. It wasn't hard, it wasn't soft. It just melted, you know, in my mouth. And just one baked bean was something which was memorable. I'll never forget their faith being. And I thought, maybe they got Jamie Oliver or something to make the baked beans for me that morning. I don't know why they were so incredibly delicious, you know, but just came from a cab. Just rolled up. But the point was that my mind was so clear, you could pick up everything, every flavour in just a single baked bean. That's what happens to you. That's why it gets fun to meditate. It's a really great experience. It's when, you know, you really start getting still, and the food always tastes delicious. That first retreat I did over in Bateman Street in Cambridge, and just student boarding houses which were not being used by the students at that time. Very cheap accommodation. But I was a student there, so I knew what happens in boarding houses. This was in 1969 or 70. People overseas always think that English cuisine is very boring. French cuisine, or Italian cuisine, or Chinese cuisine, but British cuisine, it was just potatoes, veg, and it was just a bit of meat or something. But even in those houses, try vegetarian there, we thought this is going to be really boring. It was like of all the cooks and the chefs available, that was the one to the bottom of the pile, were employed to cook for poor students. And I knew that, and so I was not looking forward, to the meals and those boarding houses on this retreat. I even thought of getting sandwiches or something. But what happened? Even the first day, the food was delicious. The people said the boarding house cooking is just really boring. This was full of flavour. Every day, it was as if this was made by a Michelin 5-star boarding house chef. And of course, it was nothing to do with the chef. Everything to do with my mindfulness was so awake. Whatever flavour was left after all of that boiling, I could pick up. That's why it was delicious. And that's one of the reasons why it's fascinating to understand about just happiness. My feeling is very strong. Everything looks incredible. So that's the awareness. It's not just awareness, it's powerful awareness. And when you get into this deep meditation, wow, you can see. Would I keep that favourite poem? To see a world with a grain of sand. That takes really powerful awareness. Heaven in a wild flower. To see this incredible portraits, beauty in this dirty old carpet. Have a look around. How many greens there are just in that carpet? And the different shades of green. And just even the texture of the carpet. And so the contours of that carpet. After a while, you look at that carpet. Wow. I've been treading on that all day. It's amazing what's going on. Your awareness really opens up. You're not going crazy. You're becoming very clear-minded. You're becoming awake. How much? Can you speak more into the microphone? No. I'm missing a lot of what you are saying. Nah, not worth much. But the point is, you're saying a lot of matter. Okay, I'll try my best, but if you don't hear it, please put your hand up, or just please, shout. We're trying our very best to try and speak into the microphone. It's sometimes difficult, I must admit, when you are doing the sutta class, because sometimes you're looking at the sutta and you can't be looking at the microphone. So if that is happening too much, please let me know. Or you can come up to the front. Oh, what else can I do? Oh, you can learn lip reading. No? Okay. We'll try our best. How to wish to be free of suffering and that other, and that other be free of suffering. No, somebody else be free of suffering. But not averse to suffering. I think I'm averse to all the suffering occurring in the world which causes me to suffer. That's how the people suffer. Suffering is, we try to alleviate it, but we can't obliterate it for others because we don't know how to let go of it ourselves. The way you see what suffering is our teacher. I am not your teacher, Venerable Chanda, suffering. That is why Ajahn Chah used to say we used to have all these mosquitoes biting us. And when we, the first year, 45 years ago in Northeast Thailand, when the Western monks, we were the first in that area. And this is no exaggeration. When I used to go on by myself, walking here, walking there, in some of these villages, I was the first white man they'd ever seen, let alone the white monk. I remember going in one village, and the people on Andhra, they were stunned. There were no TVs in those days, maybe newspapers, but that wasn't just very clear. And I remember just going on Andhra, and the rule was, if you go on Andhra with your bowl, you weren't supposed to look in the eyes of the monk or look at them at all, just put the food in the bowl. And this village, there's no sticky rice, that's all you used to get. And instead of following the tradition, they couldn't help but look at me. And so most of the sticky rice fell outside the bowl. The dogs loved me because they got most of the food. But so there you were in these jungles of Thailand, and mosquito. Oh, first of all, Ajahn Chah, when we started a new monastery, he would come every day just to support it, to make sure that he got his a stamp of approval. But he would insist on meditating from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. before he gave his talk. Outside there was no hall. Under the trees. Sounds romantic, doesn't it? In the jungles, under the trees with the great master, simple, just meditating just like the Buddha. But the difference between the jungles in Thailand and the Bodh Gaya, it was a number of mosquitoes. And especially the time. 6 to 8 was dinner time for the mosquitoes. And also over there, see, it's a little bit cold over here in the UK, so we have a little jacket over our shoulders. If you see Thailand, it's all bare shoulders, bare arms, bald head. Imagine for the mosquitoes, this is more seats at the dinner table. And so, we were eaten alive by these mosquitoes. I did have to mention the first white people there, so it's the first time I'd ever had Western food. So, with my friend, he's a US guy, eventually, he disrobed and has rebounded. That's another story. Anyway, can't tell me going to this one, because actually, he got, 1 year got married, 2 years he got killed in a head-on crash. But anyway, but that's another thing. It doesn't mean you shouldn't disrobe, that was just a bad one. But anyway, we used to count the mosquitoes on our arm, see who got the most. You get to, and this is not one of those fisherman's stories, the fish that got away. This was real, 70 or 80, and afterwards you couldn't count because they're too close together. is very irritating. And so we complained to Roger, can we get some mosquito repellent? Can we get some mosquito coils? Can we get some anything to keep the mosquitoes off? Let meditate another time of the day. And what did Ajahn Chah say? No. And he said, call those mosquitoes Ajahn mosquitoes. They're your teacher. Isn't that, as usual, the trouble with Ajahn Chah? He was always right. So, what did you do? You had a 2 hour sit, sometimes after 5 or 10 minutes, looking around, a lot of Thai monks, they weren't irritated at all. I found out later because they didn't get bitten by the mosquitoes. Westerners got more of the mosquito bites than the Thai monks did. And anyway, that Ajahn Chah was there. If Ajahn Chah was there, they'd run away. But anyway, you had to endure. But endurance wasn't really the way. So instead, when I started meditating, I knew I couldn't mess around. I had to follow the procedure of restraining myself, being still, watching the breath. And soon, you got to a place where, you're just watching the breath, and when deep inside, you could feel mosquitoes on your arm. You weren't aware of your body anymore. You're aware of just going deep inside of yourself. And thank you, mosquitoes, for making sure I didn't waste my time in meditation and get into a deep state of stillness. The weird part was, when you came out after the meditation, after 2 hours, nice and peaceful, and really sort of a little bit of bliss, I looked at my arm, and there was no signs of any mosquito bites. Usually you have a mosquito bite, and you can see a little welt come up, a little pimple or something. But no, there's nothing. I thought, wow, the power of samadhi, the power of deep meditation, makes you invulnerable to mosquitoes. There's only later on, there's nothing psychic or supernatural, because total science, mosquitoes are attracted to the carbon dioxide coming out of the pores of your skin. So, the more you metabolize, the more you're worried and tense, the more you metabolize, the more carbon dioxide comes out, the more the mosquitoes know you're there. The more you worry, it's like saying, Mozzie, over here please. But when you really calm down, and your metabolism just really drops, there's hardly any carbon dioxide coming out of your skin. The mosquitoes can't find you. You're visible. Very simple, but very powerful. So, sometimes the suffering is where you learn. Suffering is your teacher. What about other people's suffering? Sometimes, if we didn't have suffering, there'd be no incentive to look for freedom in other ways. Because of old age, sickness and death, the Buddha left home and went on the spiritual search to see an answer to all of this. Life isn't perfect. If it was, who would need to practice? Because of old age, sickness and death, the Buddha's arise in the world to teach, to lead other people to freedom. Questions. What do you think of the word focus instead of concentration? Focus also takes too much effort. It's just a natural, just the mind converging. What do you think of the word reflect? Reflect what? Reflect means the mirror and the person looking in the mirror, instead of contemplating. Instead of contemplating, I like explore. What's the difference between awareness and consciousness? Already answered. Where can I buy the Book of the Sutras that you translated? You can buy the Book of the Sutras translated in the future. If you want one now, just go and call Doctor Who. Apparently it's still going, Doctor Who. I remember seeing that when I was a kid, and the old police box. Does he still have a piece of his box? The TARDIS. I still remember the name, TARDIS. I don't know if he still has that one. It's supposed to, because the TARDIS, the old police boxes they used to have on the street, I remember those as a kid, they, you know, they're supposed to be inconspicuous. So maybe these days, Doctor Who comes in an iPhone. Anyway, your trade with Agent Jar was full of hardship. Really? I could leave if I wanted to. Hardship was so much joy and fun and almost like adventure there. I was never a masochist. I never did this because I had some karmic debt to pay off. No, when I first wanted to become a monk, I went to the old Wat Buddha Pratipa in East Sheen, Richmond, to get some sort of way of becoming a monk. And there's even one of the lay people, they had been a monk with Ajahn Chah, and they disrobed and they'd gone back to do stuff in England. And the monks at Wat Buddha Pratipa, the Thai monks, said, oh, go and talk to that monk, he's that lay person, he's just come back from Thailand. So I talked to him. He never told me about Ajahn Chah. And later on when I saw him, I said, why didn't you, I found Ajahn Chah myself, but why didn't you tell me about that monk? And he said, because you were always smiling, I didn't think you were serious about becoming a monk. As if you have to be suffering, or psychotic, or depressed, fed up with the world, to actually to start wanting to become a monk. But no, that wasn't my part. I was already happy. I just wanted to increase it a bit. Actually, quite a lot. And find out why. Why do people always think that people have to go, this is actually part of Thai culture. They think you only go to a temple if you have a problem. So all the villagers, they look at the people going into the temple, especially the women, and they think, oh, their marriage is on the rocks. Why else would they go to the temple? So no, it's for happiness. It wasn't hardship. It was austerity, but it's the main thing that made it, you almost like the simplicity of it. The simplicity was just so amazing. That time, I keep, looking back upon that time with just so much joy. The time when, after 5 years, everything you owned, all your possessions, your bowl, mosquito net, umbrella, and a few other things, you put on your back and you walked. You walked all over the place, up to the northeast of Thailand, to the north of Thailand, with all your possessions you were carrying. And soon it became so light. I never felt so free and unburdened with possessions before. No monastery, no duties, obviously no phones or mobile phones. You had every day you can just go walking whichever direction you wanted. You go to a crossroads and decide to go left, right, straight ahead, or just turn around and go back the way you came. Absolute freedom there. And you knew your financial security, didn't need any money. Just a place to stay, any forest, any paddock, you'd have a place. For hygiene, go to a well, go to a river, have a bathe. What else? Food in the morning. Any village, you could just go with your bowl and go miles around. You would always get what you like. You'd have enough to keep going. That was just, just like a taste, like the what it would have been like in the time of the Buddha. Let's go free. Anyway, hardship. I look back upon that as like golden years. Oh, meditate all night long once a week. All night long once a week was just that I did not agree with, because most of the monks actually never did meditate all night long. Most most of the monks are tired and now they went to their cooties to meditate. Flat out. It's very rare to see people meditating all night, and sometimes that you did that, and what happened is in the morning time when you woke up, when you when you woke up, you were sitting there, you learned how to meditate with dullness. And what happened was that it took a couple of days for us to get your energy back, and then you can start sort of meditating properly again. But there are other times when you really were hot on your meditation, and then you meditate all night just naturally, not on one particular night. Sometimes it was going well, really peaceful, and carry on meditating. But don't make it such that you have to meditate all night on these particular days. I never saw any monk making great progress with that technique. It's only Ajahn Chah did it. All the other monks, Ajahn Mahabodhi's monk, never did that. Anyway, do you not think your effort should be matched by others in order to get similar results? No. You won't get similar results. Improve on what you're taught. Not just do the same because it's tradition. Tradition can be good, but it's suited to that time. And in particular, the Laotian tradition is much more Lao. That's what they spoke up in the northeast and Thai. And the Laotians were one of the most laid-back people I'd ever seen in my life. Some people call it lazy, but it was quite laid-back. They had no water in the streams, had fish, which they just keep all year, the rotten fish. If they didn't need to work, they wouldn't. It was 3-4 day. This particular story, one of my friends, he was English, from English public school, decided to become a drug runner instead of getting a proper job. Did it very well, and he retired to Luang Prabang in Laos. So he was there before the communist takeover. He was there at the communist takeover afterwards. He told all these amazing stories about Lao culture, even at war. So he went into this bamboo and thatch restaurant cafe. He would never ever pass health and safety standards in UK, but the food was delicious. You know, those street vendors sometimes you see in sort of poor countries, but this was really delicious food. So he was having his lunch in the restaurant, and he saw there were some government soldiers in one of the tables having their lunch. Their M16 assault rifles were leaning against the thatch. They were enjoying their lunch. And he said he almost dived under the table when he saw the communist troops come into the same restaurant, also fully armed. But what did the communist troops do? They just sat at another table. They put their guns against the wall and ordered their lunch. He discovered in Laos, wars always stop for lunch. Food is more important. And actually, to contemplate that is just mind-boggling. But if you've ever seen that, that culture at that time, you understand why. They had an understanding that after lunch, the communists would go left, and the government soldiers would go right, so they wouldn't meet each other. They could ambush each other or whatever, and they went into that. So that was, I said, it's the most lazy culture I've ever seen. But it was very cute that way. So simple. You didn't have to work. Why work? So anyway, in the end, so understanding the culture, that's why Ajahn Chah would push them so much. And the Westerners thought, you know, Westerners were just so motivated, so driven to become a monk, travel all that way, doesn't matter what's going to happen, we're going to meditate. You don't know Westerners would actually actually understand that and say, oh, we really got to do this. We're going to meditate all night. And actually, the child sometimes had to stop us and relax some more. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, how do I create an aversion when I see a beauty even in the pimples? you're beyond hope. There's always something or danger. But it's really true that in that part of Thailand, many of the, especially the Western monks, I would go into the jungles, and first of all, you're always afraid of tigers. Because tigers, they would eat people. But Ajahn Chah said, and he said, tigers don't eat monks. And he said, there's never a case, and he never heard himself of a monk being eaten by a tiger. And I said, well, you wouldn't know, would you? The tiger wouldn't confess. And you know, so I didn't believe that, but it was very true. There's more danger, not from tigers, but from Thai girls. I saw more monks eaten by Thai girls than Thai girls. It's nothing to do with Thai girls or women or anything, but just, you know. Sorry?
It's to do with the monk.
Yeah, doing the monk. So it was, yeah, exactly. Anyway, so I mean, when lust is very strong, how do we overcome that? Now, that's a good question. Lust doesn't become very strong out of the blue. You actually cultivate it. You actually get really into even getting angry at someone. There's a certain energy and delight in getting angry at somebody. And sometimes that I remember seeing in protests. Protests for really good causes. And then somehow the group mentality kicks in and you get very, very upset. And the classic case is how many people have seen that religious classic, The Life of Brian. And do you remember that time, those of you who have seen it, where they had this protest group, this rebel group, the PLP or LP or something, I don't know exactly what it was, but anyway, they were having a meeting to try and rebel against the Roman occupation of Palestine. And one of them said, now out with the Romans. What have the Romans ever done for us? Roads. The Romans are incredible road builders. Now you'd be going along with your car and it was so uneven that your axles would break, you'd get stuck in the mud. But thanks to the Romans, now we can take our carts anywhere. It's much more efficient and fast. And they never get broken. Thanks to the Romans, great roads. Oh yeah, I suppose that's true. Well, apart from roads, what have the Romans ever done for us? Actually, law and order. You couldn't go out on a Saturday night in some parts of Palestine before the Romans came. You know, you'd get robbed. But thanks to those Romans, you've got law and order. That's a point. What, apart from roads and law and order, what have the Romans ever done for us? Sanitation and water. Yeah, okay. What do I? Education. They taught us how to write Latin. Oh, yeah, Pa. What have they ever done for us? Economy. Now we can send apples or mangoes, whatever we have, all over the empire. Oh, yeah. What have the Romans ever done for us? Other than roads, water, sanitation, law and order, economic prosperity. Nothing! Out with the Romans. That was a classic little skit. Just a satire of just how people love getting angry. What has my husband ever done for me? Nothing, nothing! The divorce. That's getting a bit close to the boat, isn't it? Anyway, so that's actually, we cultivate lust. We cultivate anger. We cultivate greed. something to do. There's a certain sense of we exist when we're angry. Ah, you're alive. But it does burn you. And it takes away a lot of your natural energy, so you get depressed afterwards. Worn out, tired. What is Dhamma? Nothing isn't. Would you please explain? That is a bit just too simplistic. Nothing isn't Dhamma. This was explained, I've got to give credit to this, to Fennel Bhikkhu Bodhi. In one of his books, he just explained at length what Dhamma actually means, get the heart of what Dhamma means. Dhamma means like, you know, whatever you're experiencing now, the source of it, why it comes up, where it comes from. Similar to, like, say, the law of gravity. Why do things fall? You know, what is the general principles in which why, you know, the moon circulates around the earth, or, you know, why planets turn light, you know, that's the general theory of Einstein. It's the source going into to the why of life, where it comes from. And because the Dhamma, it has an antonym, its opposite, which is called Atta. And that is where the consequences, the meaning, where it leads to. So the Dhamma, like the Four Noble Truths, that's, you know, not the theories, that's the laws which govern nature, your life. That's why, instead of having all these incredible experiences you have, just trying to systemize why they happen, where it comes from. And the Atta is where it leads to. Beautiful to this understanding of Dhamma and Atta. If I remember correctly, today, Monday, you said something along the lines that Vinaya Loke Abhita Gomanasa means restraining the five hindrances. And Vinaya means, like, Vinaya is discipline, Vinaya means like restraining. Please kindly forgive and correct me if I have misunderstood. Does this refer to practicing the third, fourth, and fifth factors of the Noble Eightfold Path? Is this either Sila Path or the sixth path, which is Samoyama, which you translate as right restraint? These eight factors are not sort of individual, separated, independent. You can do one without the others. They are all predicated, founded on the right view, first of all, which I didn't mention. Simple things like no ownership, not mine, not me, not a self. That you're not in here to enhance the self with more and more achievements. You may notice that any person who has, say, jhanas, you're not awarded a stripe on the side of your road for first jhana. The second stripe is to show you if it got second. You don't put pips on the, like in the military, on your shoulder to show that you got this stage of enlightenment or that stage of enlightenment. These are not achievements, these are states of letting go, vanishing, showing that things are missing from you. Good example of that. There was a retreat center in Colombo. It closed down a few years ago. This is why. They would actually have a retreat for a couple of months. Not just meditation, but study as well. With a lot of teachers. And you would be assessed as you went along. At the end of the retreat, it was almost like giving you an exam. And on the basis of your experiences in meditation, your understanding of the Dhamma, the teachers will meet together, and sometimes they will give you certificates. Certificates to show that you had achieved a jhana, or you had one stage of enlightenment or the other. And it became very popular for a while. The people needed confirmation. You know, that you might say you've got a jhana, but have you really? Have you really sort of broken through and seen non-self and become a stream winner? So has his panel of experts in Colombo, to tell you. So what happened? There was this really nice old auntie, you know, from the up country, and she came to visit her children and grandchildren, nieces and nephews in Colombo. And the family met together. They had so much gratitude for this old woman who'd worked so hard all her life looking after them, and now they were, you know, doctors and engineers, business people over in Colombo. So they said, why don't we sponsor her for one of these retreats? Good idea. So they got together and they asked the grandma, would you like to go on this retreat for 2 months? It's supposed to be really good. She said, oh yeah.